George Howard spoke with artist Zoe Keating about the effects COVID-19 is having on the music ecosystem, her own revenue streams, and what her path forward may look like. All of the music in this episode has been performed by Zoe Keating and is used with her permission. Visit zoekeating.com for more.
It's not talked about enough, this idea of, okay, be an independent artist, essentially be your own manager, be your own, you know, label, whatever, also create art, and then also have a life. And there's, you know, be a mom, be a single mom, you know, and the opportunity costs there. I mean, things break, you know, and it's like, I think we, as on the business side of things, are often too eager to be just like, well, no, you can do this all yourself. It's like, well, you can, but something's gonna suffer and break. And so I'm curious about like how you navigate that, both, you know, just generally, and then also, I mean, the thread of these pieces for are about, you know, I think the independent musicians are being left out of the conversation about quarantine land. It's like, there's no voice for that. So I'd love to just hear you talk about things generally.
Well, that's always been true. I don't think independent artists have necessarily been the center of most discussions around what's happening in the music industry. But however, that was changing. I've been noticing, you know, over the last few years that, you know, more and more artists are along that, you know, it's not like you have an artist who is DIY and then you have an artist who has a huge team and, you know, has record labels. There's like such a spectrum there, a different thing. Like when I first started out, the idea of being a DIY artist was really radical and not necessarily respected. It was just seen as a stepping stone to something else.
Right.
Like you're only doing this until you get established enough to, you know, slot yourself into the machinery.
Correct.
And then really over the last few years, it's evened out a bit. And so that a lot of people approach me who are younger who want to do it my way.
Yeah, well, you're an example, you know.
And then there's sort of you know, a spectrum of there's people who do everything themselves, and then like, you know, I am DIY in a lot of respects, but I still have a team that consists of my booking agent and my licensing agent and my attorney. So
yeah,
that's like my, you know, that's sort of my team that I have. So actually right now I feel like I'm more worried about them.
Yeah, you're not the first who said that. I talked with Joe Pug for a Forbes piece too, and he said, you know, in a very, very genuine way, look, I'll probably be okay. You know, like I can find new issues, but it's all of those around me that you know, so talk about that a little bit. I mean, what are your concerns?
Well, for example, you know, one of the first things I did, you know, as soon as I was kind of lucky that I had a short tour that ended on the 4th of March. And I was vigilant the whole time, wondering if those shows would have to be canceled. And then after the 4th of March, we came home and all my future concerts were canceled. The first thing I did was analyze, okay, exactly how much of my income right now is live, because it shifts.
Do you mind sharing kind of generally what, like, if in the pie chart of your total P&L?
Sure. I think it's interesting to know. You know, I generally do kind of a, you know, profit loss for my accountant, and, you know, and so for last year, for 2019, I was actually surprised to learn that concerts were 48% of my gross income. I had not actually expected it to be that high, because, you know, it shifts for every artist every year. And I was surprised that it had actually had increased to that. And, you know, maybe I toured more last year than I did in other years. But this year, just because it was only the first quarter, I had so far this year had live had been 30% of my gross income. Mm-hmm. But that's because the summer hadn't happened yet.
Correct.
You know.
Right. It's seasonal. Yeah.
Yeah. And then other parts there, actually, I can tell you because I just wrote it down. Hang on just a second. Let's see. Yeah, so in 2019, which was really like the last normal year, live performance was 48%. Performance royalties, this was what was surprising, performance royalties were 16%. So that's ASCAP. And then composing and licensing was 20%. So, and then there's other things, like I was surprised that streaming only made 10% of my income. And direct to fan, Bandcamp, which in my mind, I think of as being a huge source of my, how I'm able to live. That was only 5%.
Wow.
That kind of blew my mind.
And you're really, you've got like a diversified portfolio. I mean, like you have the other stream, the public performance income, that's pretty big. Like that, you know, for most quote unquote DIY artists, that's a big percentage of the pie. And then you do get your music licensed into film and TV as well. So the upfront money from those, the fees on those are material. Yeah. But the streaming and the Bandcamp is of the, those are the smallest slices of the pie.
Yeah. Yeah. I was really surprised. And in a way it's like, well, did I release anything last year? No, I didn't. So that's a non-release year. Mm-hmm. I should I'm still in the process of, calculating all my expenses and all that stuff for my accountant so I can actually finish my taxes from last year, because I was filing an extension, another postponement. Sure. But I should compare it to 2018. And I was, anyway, long story short, I did all this because I really wanted to make sure I knew what my real reality is so that I can make decisions going forward, because my concerts are canceled for a year. Everything's being rescheduled for May next year. And so the performance royalties have been really great because they have really kept coming in this year, because last year I had something on a major network show. Yeah. And so that major show was syndicated into it and sent out to other countries and dubbed in other languages. And so those international royalties, so this year, like performance royalties have been 20%. And they have been, I've been so grateful for that ASCAP check.
Yeah. Well, you and I have both, spoken publicly about, how performance royalties generally is still too much of a kind of modeling, not measuring, and sort of, it's a system that I think we both agree
it's clunky.
Yeah,
it's a good way to say it. And this is just television, which is very specific. It's not radio or anything. It's just TV.
Right. So you get the cue sheets, which are a little bit more accurate, but, and arguably like it's, the reason it's lined up for you well, but like that's money that was probably paid out, and, the blanket license fee for those songs for that network was probably paid a year ago, and it's finally finding its way to you. Right.
Yeah, that's actually like the payments that just came in, which were really handy because my concerts were canceled, is from summer of 2019. So this is such a huge, slow moving operation. And I know, speaking with my agent, there's nothing in the pipeline for the fall because nobody's making any shows or nobody's filming. So, that concerns me. Like, I think I have a feeling that, all that licensing stuff and the performance royalties from TV is going to decline, but I'm not going to feel that until later.
That's right. It's a lagging thing. Yeah. So right now you're enjoying the benefit of that lag, but then it's going to just be a valley. Right.
Yeah.
And sorry.
Oh, I was going to say, and the only reason that this is, it's a scary year. Like, I'm careful and, I know already from past personal life experience with my husband's illness that you have to be prepared for anything. Things can fall apart at any time. I know that more than a lot of people. And so I've always made sure that I have at least 6 months or more saved up. Because the industry is fickle and I always feel like my career could disappear at any second. So I'm always ready for that. But the other thing is that I own my publishing. And so there are artists I know right now who they don't own their publishing. They have to share a lot of their profits with their record label, from the writer side. And and the publisher side, you know, so they're really hurting. And then to get back into the, you know, the structure of it, like, I want my booking agency to survive and thrive through the year.
Yes, of course.
And then my licensing agent, are they going to have to lay off some of their staff over the summer? Yeah. And then all the crew, you know, like my sound right. man, he's freaking right. out. Like there's nothing, right. he doesn't get royalties.
Right.
Like
right.
I'll get a little royalty check, but what is he going to get? So I'm really yeah. worried about everybody. And, you know, my sister worked, she was the manager of a music venue and they're shut for a year. And luckily she just found a different job in a different industry like yesterday. But you know, it's like, that's all a mess.
I'm glad that she found another job, but it does speak to the idea that and I said this early on, I'm most terrified that on the other end of this, whatever this might be, and when it ends, we're just going to have less artists. We're just going to have less, you know, people are, you know, and that's in the grand scheme of things, that's a societal choice too, right? That's how we as a society sort of determine what type of quality of life we want. There are ways in which we could, as a society, be supporting these people who generate arts who have had their existences just gone, and we're choosing not to have bailouts for those types of people. And so, you know, you get the society you deserve, and we'll come out on the other end of these. And as you say, all these people who don't have a flow of royalties from kind of disparate elements, it's just the money just stopped. Just dried up, gone, you know? And so, I mean, what are you technique-wise or approach-wise doing now as you kind of rethink your business? You know, the sort of rosy picture, I don't want to be Pollyanna-ish, but I do think there is some sense of, okay, artists are being forced to find new revenue streams, and maybe those continue on even as the business mm-hmm. begins to, you know, come back to something that resembled what it was before.
Yeah. Well, I think that's something I'm continually doing, because the only constant I've experienced in this industry is change.
Change.
It's constantly changing.
It's the world.
And I think because, you know, 5 years ago, I had to figure out how to tour less. I've been doing that already. I was already touring, like, in a way, the bare minimum. Because don't, you know, for me to tour means my mother has to come and stay here, or my son has to come with me. And both those are difficult choices. So I had already been trying to make as many legs on my stool as possible. What's the leg now? One thing that I've never done is I've never gone the route of subscription stuff.
Yeah.
And I think that's next. I've really resisted it. And I think I'm going to start. I had a new album in the works. And as soon as I can get some more support for my son, somebody to, you know, schooling or daycare or something, I'm going to get back to work on it. But I think I'll probably end up releasing songs as they go. I have a lot of live recordings I could release. But I'm not going to just put them out on Spotify.
No,
that would be stupid. I'm gonna release them to my core fans. So that's what I'm looking at next. And then the other thing is, you know, as it's really dawned on me in the last few weeks that I'm not going to have another concert probably for a year.
Right.
And sure, concerts are an important part of my income, but more important than that, playing a concert for me is like my version of going to church.
Yes.
That's the biggest thing. That's why I'm an artist. Like, I need to do that.
Right. No, it's an imperative. It's who we are. It's our, I'm always a Mr. Purpose, not product. None of us who are musicians or artists generally got into it so that we could make money. We did it because we couldn't not do it. It's our food. It fuels our soul. And I talk a lot about the kind of skeuomorphism of like, okay, well, but I'll just put up a webcam or something. But that, no. And I'm experiencing this as a teacher. I mean, you know, for me, there's something magic and very fulfilling for me to stand in front of a group of students in that room that is just not the same when I'm doing it through a Zoom thing. And I find myself fatigued. I find myself kind of depressed after it, rather than when I do it in a classroom, I come out feeling energized. So
that's
an important point. So what are you going to do? What are you doing?
There is, you know, a lot of everybody's doing live streams, and I've been watching the medium. on the one hand, I like the fact that, hey, here is an area of the internet that is not all locked up yet. I do like the sort of, I've always enjoyed the Wild West feeling of, you know, the early days of the internet and the early days of, you know, MP3s and all that stuff. And live streaming is a bit like that. Nobody knows exactly how to do it yet. What's the best mechanism, like paying for it? What, you know, how does it work? So I've been actually sort of quietly watching a lot of artists do things and seeing what works for them. And then I've done two live streams so far in the context of other events, you know, like playing for 5 minutes or showing up at something. Both those experiences have been very difficult for me on multiple levels. Number one, technically, I play the cello with 8 live layers on a computer.
Pedals, so I had to, and loops and things. Yeah.
Yeah. So I had to connect the laptop to my desktop via light pipe, and then, you know, got a camera, and I, you know, it worked, but there's nobody to live mix. And then, I just didn't have enough arms. So I was, and also I think during a concert, there's interaction, you know, I improvise, I talk to the audience, things go wrong, we talk. I need to feel like they're there. And so one thing that I'm thinking about is that might sort of do two things at once. I'm very concerned about all my favorite independent music venues. The ones that are like the small town theaters of America that are not affiliated with Live Nation or what have you, that that I love. I just love those venues. And I think there's gonna be a lot of consolidation in this. I'm concerned about smaller players closing permanently. And so I've thought, what about doing a tour to some of those smaller theaters that I've played at, but I don't actually go there. You know, can I stream from there? Do they have a website, or is there some way I can stream presented by some theater? And that I thought those performances could be like geofenced to just be in the area. And that would cut down the size of viewers enough so that maybe I could have a performance and then I could interact with them.
That's smart.
Because if the performances are too big with too many people watching, I can't really interact.
Right.
And so a mixture of like, here, I'm going to play some songs and maybe the audience could choose what the songs are. I play for them. And then we can have a hang, and I can get from the hang maybe some of the things I want from a live performance, and maybe they can too. So that's what I'm thinking about.
I think that's really smart. And it is that, you know, somebody who's, you know, I'm a musician, but most of my time in front of people, quote unquote, audience, is a classroom, and that intangible kind of reading the room and building off of each other and kind of creating that. I mean, the Grateful Dead called it the other one. Like sometimes that other thing comes in. Mm-hmm. And Joe Pug, when he was talking about it, he's like, so I've been doing some of these where I create kind of an artificial scarcity and I have just a few people there, and I'll play a few songs that they pick. And then just to your point, and then I just talk to them. I just, you know, and I charge a certain price for that, which is a higher price. Then no, I'll go on and play for you.
Yeah.
But if you want that, I really love the geofencing thing, because like creating that artificial scarcity in a digital realm is tricky, right? I mean, it's antithetical to the whole notion of the internet. I also
always like the big, smaller shows, you know, like I've gotten bigger in some ways over the years. And so, you know, my agent will say like, oh, hey, you know, you could play in this 2000 seat room. And I have sometimes difficulty connecting with the audience when it's like that. And so I actually prefer to do, recently I've been doing, I'll do multiple nights in a smaller room. so that then I can have that intimacy that I crave, and I think the audience likes it too. Thinking about that, and the other thing is, I do wonder if it might be possible to do some micro concerts. Like, can I go to a city and play for 25 people for 5 days? Would that be possible for a higher ticket?
Yes.
That's the other thing I'm thinking of.
and so you get the sort of social distancing and
yeah.
But again, like you said, and I've been saying this a lot too, and we're similar in this way. Like when you put it better than I can put it, but like we're at that stage in the same way that we were in the early days of the internet and the early days of the CD or wherever, where you say it's sort of the Wild West. And there is a sort of leveling agent there where it's like everybody's trying to figure this out. And the incumbents, the Live Nations, the big bands or whatever, they don't have the same imperatives. They can kind of coast along. They don't have that sort of necessity to say, no, we're going to figure this out. And that's why the innovation always comes from people like yourself, kind of on the margin where it's like, no, this isn't like, oh, let's experiment with them. This is my livelihood. So I have to figure this out. Mm-hmm. And I'm not trying to sort of put rose colored glasses on this situation because it's just terrible all around, but some innovations will come out of it and they always come out of people mm-hmm. like you. One of the things I wanted to ask you about is like, you're always so transparent about that. Like I think you're the only artist that I know of who just literally puts your royalty statements up on.
Sure.
Why do you do that?
It's not, I think Americans in particular have an issue with measuring their self-worth with the amount of money that they make. And I just don't feel that connection. So I don't have that shame, you know, if I haven't earned enough, whatever enough is, but I'd still do it because I feel that transparency is important, because how can you improve what you're not measuring? Oh, did I just lose you?
You did, my stupid. I put it on do not disturb and it still worked, but you said so. It was really important.
How can you improve what you're not measuring? We've been seeing this with the pandemic. Like, how can you respond to something that you're not measuring? Like, if you don't know how many cases there are in your town, how do you know what measures to put in place to protect people? You know, like, you have to have data in order to...
You can't measure it, it doesn't exist.
Exactly. And so I just felt initially years ago that there was a lot of discussion about the music industry is broken, nobody's making any money, and streaming's gonna fix it. And I said, wait a minute, show me your numbers, show me your facts. And it just seemed like my experience was not being represented out there, and the experience that I have and that other musicians I know have. And so I thought, if we're gonna talk about streaming becoming the way that artists are gonna earn a living, let's look at that. Let's investigate what that looks like. And so
with data, not yeah, just weird sort yeah. of opinions and Dunning-Kruger, like, well, exactly. This industry,
And this is my, me being, you know, I did spend some years as an information architect and a data analyst, and right. it's the same thing. Like, how could you build a system if you don't know what's in it or who's
you
using
can't.
It? So I was just applying the same principles here. And I honestly did think that if I started just releasing my earnings to see, you know, okay, well, this is my reality, not necessarily with evaluating, just releasing them, I thought that other people would do it because why not? And I think it hasn't necessarily happened because of what I stated before, that people sometimes do connect their self-worth to what they make. And also, the music industry is a place where everybody's trying their hardest to look bigger than they actually are.
A lot of puffing. Yeah. It's a lot of puffing.
Yeah. What does my licensing agent do? You know, oh, mm-hmm. the Zoe's works are so used. We can't possibly give it to you for less. You know, that's what they do. And he does it really well. And he might be true. It might be correct, you know, but that's how agents work. And that's how the whole business works. And so I think if suddenly an artist shows that they're not earning very much, maybe they'd have some fear that might, you know, take some opportunities away. And artists are generally powerless. And
I know.
In a way, like, asking them to put all of their earnings online is like, for some people, it's like taking away power from them. So,
yeah, but the, and I understand that. And but there's the flip side of that is that the transparency leads to what I call ethical fiber, where it leads mm-hmm. to this sort of bond of trust, where the people that care about you and your art, and they see you with that transparent gesture, that's only going to tighten their connection to you, and mm-hmm. and in that way, it reduces your marketing costs. It, mm-hmm. it keeps your customers, your fans, tighter to you. They'll support mm-hmm. you more. So, I mean, yeah, there are two ways to look at it. One, I don't want to present my numbers because it may drive the perceived value down. The other is, no, I'm going to show this accurately mm-hmm. because then people will understand better what things look like and they'll want yeah. to support more. And I think you strike a really great balance on that, because you don't put your fees for your licensing, you put your Spotify royalties and those types of things.
No, I mean, there. I don't publish everything because I can't publish those.
Yeah, they're under NDA.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, I'm not legally necessarily allowed to. I'm not the only party involved. Right, I'm lucky for something like, you know, a royalty payment that I'm the only person who's being paid. Yeah. So, so I can do that. But I don't know. I think there is another topic, which is probably a whole other podcast, in that there is a part of this where I have noticed sometimes that if I've done particularly well during a period that I post earnings, there's always the collection of people who replies, well, she's just getting that money for sitting there. I have to go to work. And Americans can get really resentful at the idea of artists earning money from their works, because there's still something in our culture where we still don't value the arts as labor.
Or teachers, to be quite honest. I mean, that's what I mean about we as a society sort of have to choose. You know, and of course you're right. Like, artists are viewed somehow societally as somehow less than many, many other professions. And mm-hmm. if you look at it, it doesn't make sense in the scheme of things, because art's durable. You know.
But you know, I've noticed that. I would say that those are the few in general, but I do notice that whenever there's a cycle that I release statements and people comment on it and there's a news story, there's always some people who say, well, you know, this isn't, you know, who is this person taking all this money? They don't deserve it because they're just an artist, you know? So, I haven't reached megastardom at any point in this. So that I haven't quite had, you know, the issues that maybe some other artists would have, but I'm still pretty small scale in the grand scheme of things.
Yeah, but your impact is large. And I mean, I reference you an awful lot in my teaching, and in my writing, obviously, too. There's a part of me that is looking forward to not you always being my first and sometimes only call when I'm looking for someone with a voice that is a true independent artist, that is transparent, that does all those things. I mean, I'm big on the like collisions, and you taught me that to a certain degree because of your information architecture. I remember one of our early conversations, you were like, well, my original fan base grew out of the fact that I sort of, there was this whole world of people in the tech space that I sort of, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but they sort of adopted me, you know, and like that catalyzed something in my brain. I now tell artists all the time, it's like you've got to find these collisions, you know, because if you're just preaching to, you're making it very one dimensional. So you may not have reached mega stardom, but you've blazed this sort of career that's so inspiring and on your own terms and against some of the most challenging.
I think I'm blushing.
But in some of the most challenging circumstances that any human can go through. So I love your insights about the different ways in which you could, you know, the small scale venues, the live streams to small subsets of people. I mean, I really want these talks and my articles to be prescriptive, to get people's wheels kind of spinning, because you do inspire people and you don't get the credit that you deserve for it. But at this point, I think we all have to sort of galvanize around and go like, let's share the information. Mm-hmm. Let's share best practices. And that's why I'm doing these pieces of podcasts.
I think it's great. I think that there is something there in the live stream that I haven't seen anybody crack yet. But I think that there's a lot of potential for, like you said, individuals to have the same leverage as a corporation can have. You know, that they can take advantage of these tools and their audience and make something. And you know, my favorite thing to watch right now during the pandemic has been TikTok. I don't use it except to sort of observe what's happening. But, you know, all the, you know, it's not music per se, but the, of course, the lip syncs that are coming out of Maria Dakotas doing Mario Cuomo and Sarah Cooper doing Donald Trump. And all the scores people are doing, all the little, you know, lesser ones that aren't quite, haven't elevated yet. That's, you know, I love it when somebody who is without institutional support just emerges from a new tool and becomes as popular as something in the mainstream. Like, I love that moment when that happens. So.
Me too. It's Grandmaster Flash and, you know, pulling a record backwards and DJ Kool Herc locking into a sound system and creating hip hop out of thin air, you know. But again, innovation comes on the margin and from marginalized people, never from institutions and from people taking tools and reconfiguring them. I mean, you've done it with your cello, right? I mean, it's just the way your brain works, I think, you know. And so that same, it's a mindset, and that same mindset that caused you at some point to go, no, I'm going to start looping my cello long before others were doing that, is the same mindset that will say, no, I Zoe will reconfigure this live streaming or combine it with TikTok or whatever, and something new will emerge. I just think we have to distribute that knowledge better.
Well, if you hear of musicians who are doing it really interestingly, I'd like to know, because I actually feel like I'm not being that innovative right now. I'm mostly just being a mom, because the thing is, like, you know, I haven't had the liberty to spend all my time in the studio, like, figuring out new ways to connect and all this stuff. I've been homeschooling my son and trying to hold up the sky for him, because, you know,
And that's all that really matters, but in holding up that sky, which is quite a metaphor,
that's what we do. I mean, that's what parents are doing. That's what parents are doing around the world right now.
I know. And my anxiety and my emotional well-being is directly correlated to that of my kids. And so, you know, we're all trying to hold up the sky. In doing that, I think sometimes there are byproducts that are innovative for my work and your work as well, where, like, I'm forced to hold up that sky. Part of holding up that sky for me is finding ways to make money so that I can keep food in there. And so it's all a through line for me. It's the whole purpose, not product, and then byproducts of that. But I bet you, in holding up the sky for your son, there will be new ways that affect not only your own output as a creator, but guide others too. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the only way I can kind of get through life. Otherwise, it's just kind of like, why bother?
So are all your students right now, are they done for the year?
Yeah, the spring, summer's over. Summer's about to start. Yeah.
Uh-huh. And it's all, obviously, all distanced. Is there a plan to go back to the classroom at some point?
Yeah, I don't know when. I mean, I think the big, literally billion-dollar question is, will that be in the fall or will it be in the winter? I don't know. For me, I immediately wrote out to my students, you know, we were a campus with a purpose. Now we have to be, you know, purpose without a campus. Like the thing remains the same, you know. And but just like you're saying, I lack and I miss that sort of being in that shared space, so that space disappears. I'm sure for you, like when you're performing, you hit that flow state, right? And the audience feels it too. And the walls and everything just disappear, and there you all together, and that's the magic, and that's why we do what we do. That happens in teaching too, and it's the most profound moments. Harder through Zoom. It happens. Like I've had it. I mean, you know, I rushed into it and I got myself up on Zoom and I'd stand up and lecture and try to do, you know, just because I feel like I owe that to my students. And there would be those moments where it was like, wow, this is kind of that same magic, but it's, man, it's harder. It's just the fatigue levels.
Well, I like your idea of this podcast because one thing that you're very good at that I see, and I'm sure there's other things, is that you notice things happening and you sort of catalyze and analyze the trend and then, you know, crystallize it for a reader or something so that they can really understand it. And then that often goes off and then people reference it. So yeah. I think, so I've seen that with many of your articles over the years too. So I think, you know, if there could be anything coming out of this where people start thinking about it, that's a good thing.
Well, now I'm blushing, but thank you so much. And I appreciate your time amidst all of this. Get back to the scooter brigade or whatever. And keep me up to date with what you're thinking and working on, and I'll do the same. Thank you so much. You're such an inspiration.
Thank you for listening to George Howard's interview with musician Zoe Keating. The song used in this episode is Forte off of Zoe Keating's Snowmelt EP. You can find links to her music and social media profiles on zoekeating.com. For more from George Howard, please go to entrepreneurshipandart.com. You can also find the Entrepreneurship and Art podcast on all podcast platforms.